This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Seth Meyers, the host of NBC's Late Night. Many of us first got to know him when he anchored Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live, a position he held from 2006 to 2013. He was also a head writer on the show. He's written a new children's book called I'm Not Scared, You're Scared. The story is about a bear and his best friend, a rabbit. The bear is afraid of everything, even his own face in the mirror. The rabbit loves risky adventures. By the end of the story, the bear has shown that when he's called on to have courage to rescue his rabbit friend, he can do what needs to be done. It seems like a very timely children's book. Seth Meyers' main job is as a comic. He opens each episode of Late Night with a monologue about the day's news and then does his segment A Closer Look, which is a comic deep dive on one issue in the news. Let's hear a segment from a recent episode of A Closer Look. He was talking about the Biden administration's ban on all Russian energy imports.
Living in a world where we derive our energy from clean, renewable sources would be so much better for so many obvious reasons, including the fact that it would take power away from oppressive oil-based dictatorships. Right now, they have far too much power over both global and domestic politics because, as you've probably noticed, gas prices hit a record high this week. The numbers are so shocking, I drove by a station that had viewer discretion advised on the sign. Both Republicans and Democrats had called on Biden to ban Russian energy. Both parties. And yet, you probably won't be shocked to learn that Republicans also attacked him for high gas prices, like Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn, who tweeted, under President Trump, gas was about $2.17 in 2020. That's true. And famously, that was the only thing happening in 2020. The low gas year, as we called it. I'm just spitballing here, but maybe low gas prices had something to do with the fact that we're all trapped in our homes and no one was going anywhere. Price goes down when demand goes down. That's why you can get a DVD player for like $11 now or a Walmart card for free. Not now! It's easy to lower gas prices when no one is using gas to commute or travel or fly on airplanes. That's like presiding over a zombie apocalypse and bragging that rents are lower than ever. But yeah, now that you do mention it, I do remember when I was fleeing the city to avoid a highly contagious respiratory virus that decimated the U.S. economy and trapped everyone in their homes without toilet paper, not knowing if their jobs would ever come back or their families would survive, looking up at the gas prices and thinking, wow, $2.17 a gallon. Thank you, President Trump.
Seth Meyers, welcome back to Fresh Air. Such a pleasure to have you back on our show. You know, as we record this on Tuesday, March 8th, when we broadcast this, I hope Zelensky is still alive. Like, I don't know, you know, what to expect. But what does it mean to you that President Zelensky was a comic? He was a comic actor. He was in a comedy group before he was on television. What's it like for you as a comic writer and performer to think about that?
Every night my wife says, don't get any ideas. That's the main thing when I come home. But I think that the part of it that is the most impressive to me as I watch this is how well, look, I'm not saying any of it is performative, right? This is a person who is taking very real risks and has to rise to the occasion. But we're living in a time where, as a world leader, everything is recorded as we go through this crisis. And it seems to me that he is not, you know, has not wrong-footed any moment here. It's almost like the way someone on stage, particularly a comedian, is in control of the narrative for the course of however long they're on stage. And they are trying to, you know, convince the audience to hold the opinion they hold, often and almost entirely for comic effect. But I think he's using a lot of the same tools here. And he clearly knows how to appeal to people. And he's incredibly appealing. And I can't imagine what would the people of Ukraine would be going through right now if they didn't have a leader who had been this sure-handed so far.
And it's just great that he's using all that charisma to tell the truth and to convey genuine need, as opposed to using it to manipulate people or, you know, offer disinformation.
Yeah. And even just, it's weird to, and again, this is going to continue to be less weird because, you know, there'll be more younger leaders, or I should say leaders younger than us, who know how to use their front-facing cameras and know how to turn it around while they're walking down a hallway. And as opposed to, you know, I think we sometimes see older politicians try to use social media in a way that becomes very clear that it has just been taught to them moments before. So there's something very authentic about the way he's using modern technology and modern communication devices and means to get through to his people at a time where they need to hear from him.
You know, you got your start in a tragic time on TV doing comedy, because your first show on Saturday Night Live was the season opener after 9/11. So like, what a time to start on TV and to start doing comedy on TV. Did Lorne like take everybody in the cast aside and say, it's going to be hard to find what's funny, here's what we do? Did he give you any advice on that?
It's all such a blur to me that time for so many reasons. I think it would have been a blur if I had started SNL in 1998, when it wasn't a time like that. I think that for the people that were closer to the power structure of the show at the time, the head writers, the cast members who've been there for a long time, I think those are probably the people that Lorne powwowed with more as far as just how to approach that time. It was a whirlwind for me. You know, I'd also only lived in New York City for 2 weeks before 9/11. So I had a lot going on, but it wasn't an easy time to write sketch comedy, I will say.
And so I'm sure you do remember, in spite of the fact that that period is a blur, that in the opener, then New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani was there. And there were like people from the fire department and the police department who were like heroes. And Giuliani is there because he was considered a heroic figure then, bringing together New York in the spirit of courage. And so Lorne Michaels says to Rudy Giuliani, is it okay to be funny? And Giuliani says, why start now? And when you think about who Giuliani has become and all the jokes you've made subsequently about Giuliani, does it, your head spin a little bit?
It does spin. Bernie Kerik was there as well, another person who fell from grace post that moment. And it does spin. And I remember a few years later, when he was running for president, Rudy Giuliani came on Weekend Update. And he was someone that I continued to have a great deal of respect for. Our politics didn't align, but having lived in New York City in 2001, he did mean something to me. And there was a charm to him. I understood the pull, the charisma of Rudy Giuliani. So it is beyond head spinning to see where this has been. And the fact that I remember once being in an elevator with him a few years after that 2001 season premiere, where I was a new cast member who I think had one line in the show. He walked on an elevator with me and knew my name. And I thought, wow, this guy is a very, very good, very charming politician. So it's a very hard thing to watch. And I imagine even harder for those who, you know, believed in him politically and believed in his what he stood for.
Well, I want to get back a little later to talking about Late Night, but I want to talk with you about your new children's book, which I really like. It's called I'm Not Scared, You're Scared. And I should mention, you did not do the illustrations. You did the writing.
Yes. Thank you very much for giving credit where credit's due. Rob Saya Jr. Let's give Rob Saya Jr. a shout out now.
So I'd actually like you to read from the beginning of the book.
There once was a bear who was easily scared. Each night before going to sleep, he would tie a bell to his door that would make a noise if anyone tried to sneak in, because even a bear who is easily scared is a very heavy sleeper. He was even afraid of his own reflection, and because he couldn't see himself, he never brushed well and always had food stuck in his teeth. When you're a scared bear with food in your teeth, you don't have many friends. Bear had one, Rabbit. Rabbit was never scared. She read scary stories, she slept with her door wide open, and she brushed her teeth while hanging from a tree branch by her ears. This gave her very strong ears. One day, Rabbit made an announcement. Bear, we are going on an adventure. Bear suggested that instead of going on an adventure, they could read a book about adventures. That way, if anything goes wrong, we can just close the book. Rabbit looked at her friend and asked, Bear, are you scared? And Bear replied, I'm not scared. you're scared. And with that, Bear walked past Rabbit and out the front door.
So they actually do go on an adventure. Do you want to explain what happens?
They go on an adventure, and at every hurdle, Bear is afraid, but doesn't want to admit he's afraid. And Rabbit tries to impress upon Bear that the woods are not scary, the river is not deep, the mountain is not high. And Bear chooses instead to take the long way around all of those tasks. And at each point, Rabbit asks him if he's scared, and he continues to dig in his heel and stress that he's not scared. Rabbit's scared. But then eventually, Rabbit does something that's genuinely scary, and it goes wrong. And Bear is forced to confront his own fears to save his friend, which is the climax of the book. But it really is a book about friendship. It's about our relationship with fear. It's about the moments when you have to push past it. It's about the moments when maybe you should listen to your fear a little bit more. And hopefully it's a book that parents can read to their kids and then talk about exactly what their kids are afraid of and how they're approaching dealing with that.
Two of the things I especially liked about the book. One is the part, which is in the passage you read, in which Bear says, can we just read about an adventure instead of going on one? That way we could just close the book if it gets too scary. That would have been me.
That would have been me too. 100% me.
But, you know, I also like that Rabbit does something pretty stupid, and Bear realizes it's stupid, and Bear leaves. And then, you know, the rabbit's walking across this rickety bridge that can't hold Bear's weight, and Bear says, this is dangerous. It can't hold anything heavy. So he turns back, and the bridge collapses while Rabbit's on it, and that's why Bear has to go rescue him. Like, sometimes what seems like courage is just like stupidity, you know, like taking really stupid risks. And I like that point too, that sometimes caution really is the way to go.
Well, that's what I mean about our relationship with fear. You know, as a parent, there are things I'm frustrated my kids are afraid of, because I think as an adult, I see them as irrational fears. But there are other things I am thrilled that they're afraid of, and that their fear tells them not to go to the top of the jungle gym before they're old enough to go across the monkey bars. And that fear tells them to stop their bikes before the street. And ultimately, as a parent, you want your kids to have an internal risk meter that they're constantly maturing and growing into. And that way you can, you know, not that as a parent you're ever going to relax, but you can at least relax a little bit. Because I think nothing would be scarier to me than having a fearless child.
I know you obviously didn't intend this, but when I read the book, I was thinking about the children in Ukraine who've been forced to find courage and strength as they flee Ukraine or hide in their homes. And I'm sure they're terrified, but they're forced to rise to the occasion because they don't have a choice. And that's one of the messages in your book, that like when you're forced to, you'll find the courage. So I'm wondering if you're thinking about that at all. I mean, I know it's not what you intended.
You know, the book was written during the pandemic, which obviously was another time where I think people were wondering how to talk to their kids about fear. Although it was a weird time for us because my wife and I were far more afraid during COVID than my kids were, just because they were, I think, too young to fully process it. But there was something about the idea that we were living through a really scary time. And you want to think, and we are seeing it right now, you want to believe that the human spirit will rise to the occasion and will be courageous, especially when their courage will benefit others who are in danger. And even on a small level, you know, I do want to look back at this time and tell my kids, hey, you did a really cool thing for 2 years. You guys wore masks when you went to school, and that was great that you did that. That was this sacrifice that you did for other people. And it's a shame that moment's become so politicized, because I think, you know, I grew up at a time where I think it's arguable that I never did anything or had to do anything close to what my kids just had to go through. And so I think it's nice to be able to have these moments to say, oh yeah, you might be afraid of that, but you would rise above it if your brother or your sister were in danger. And that's something you should know about yourself.
Do you like reading to your kids?
I love reading my kids. It's my favorite thing I do. In fact, this terrible thing has started to happen, which is now my boys want me to make up a Batman and Robin story every night. And it's so exhausting. it's so soul crushing knowing I have to come up with a full superhero story every night.
Tell them to pay you.
I know.
You get paid for this work.
I'm like, look, this is not, daddy does not come cheap. I'm in guilds. I'm in SAG-AFTRA. I love reading books to them. And especially when it's a book where they just get quiet and focused. I love nothing more than seeing the faces of my children paying attention to a story.
You know, your first two children have great origin stories. So the first time your wife gave birth, she was in the Uber when she started going into labor and you made it to the hospital like just in time. And tell us the compressed version of the second time around when she didn't even make it into the Uber.
Yeah, second time around, we basically, she felt a contraction. We got in the elevator. We walked out of the elevator into our lobby. And she said, I'm having the baby right now. And I told her that was ridiculous. I should note that I'm not and have never been an OBGYN. and I know very little about the women's reproductive system. But I boldly told her that was fine. And then I kind of looked down and it was very clear from the shape of her sweatpants that she was not lying. And so she got on the ground and I would say 10 minutes later, it was also about a 40-minute drive to the hospital. So this was a huge decision by her part to stay. And she delivered the baby in the lobby. And by the time he was born, because I had called 911, not that I'm the hero in the story, but I had called 911. I mean, everybody always talks about what my wife did, but I think both her and I were pretty heroic on the day. No, but so there were police officers and firemen surrounding us when our son Axel was born.
So the day after your wife gave birth in the lobby, you did your show.
Yeah.
And your opening monologue was the story of this crazy birth. Does NBC not offer paternity leave?
Well, this is you have brought up what we like to call in our marriage a sticking point, Terry. it should be noted that I absolutely could have taken that Monday off. He was born on a Sunday morning. And everything was fine. You know, he was healthy. Mom was healthy. Her parents were in town. Her sister was in town. And to be honest, I said to her, you gotta let me go tell this story. This story's too good. I don't want to sit on it for another day. And to my wife's great credit, even she appreciated. And she also knew that the story was about, you know, her superhuman ability to deliver her own baby in a lobby. So I did have her blessing when I went in and told that story that day. And, you know, of the shows, I don't think this is a show that I will go back over the years and look back at individual closer looks per se, but I'm very happy that there is that sort of timestamp episode where I can one day show Axel, this is not even, you know, 2 days after you were born. This is your dad on TV telling the story.
You know, in your latest Netflix comedy special, which is called Lobby Baby, at the end of the special, you do comedy from your wife's point of view. You say, I always talk about my wife and my comedy, but I sometimes imagine what it would be like from her point of view. So you tell a bunch of things from her point of view. What do you think she was thinking while you were calling 911?
Well, she did say at one point in the, you know, the whole ado about having the baby in the lobby, she did look at me and say, stop writing, because she could see while it was happening. I talk to myself when I'm writing or when I'm, you know, formulating an idea, and which my wife loves to catch me doing. I would say if she has a catchphrase, it's who are you talking to when I'm alone in the kitchen? So it was like, while once everything calmed down and, you know, she was getting loaded up into the ambulance, she looked at me and she said, please stop writing, because she could tell that I was just immediately taking it and turning it into material.
So I want to ask you about a very memorable show from the recent past where John Mulaney came on and talked about his now famous intervention when his friends, including you, wanted to stop you know, hurting himself by doing so many drugs. He thought he was going out to a dinner with a friend from college, and when he opened the door, he says, the first face he saw was yours. What was it like for you interviewing him on your show and watching him turn this really awful night for him and this really awful point of his life into a really funny story?
I think that's one of the biggest upsides of being friends with incredibly funny people is you know they're going to have an ability, be it with the things they're going through or with the things you're going through, to find humor in it. And that will then make the passage through those tricky times a little bit easier to bear. And also with John's story, particularly, you know, when he tells it on our show or when he tells it on stage, you know, I really hope that it brings comfort to other people who have been through it, you know, be it on John's side of it or the rest of us that had to make that, you know, difficult decision to step in.
Can you talk at all what the intervention was like from your point of view?
I would just say it's really scary because you don't know how your friend's going to react to it. And you collectively, with a lot of other people you trust, know what the right path forward is. You know, this is someone you love and someone you believe is, you know, as smart as anyone you've ever met. And so you're just really hopeful going into it that they're going to agree with the decision you all made without them. But it was emotionally really exhausting. But, you know, insofar as the things you do in your life that take a lot out of you, there are very few that mattered more than that one.
Did you have to speak at the intervention?
I insisted. I made it clear, like, I don't do interventions unless I have a big part. Everyone involved got a chance to speak.
It's something, must have been odd to prepare your remarks for that and think of what to say.
It was. I think in any circumstance, it's always scarier to write something when you know it's in a room full of writers, even in something, something with stakes like that. But I can only imagine, no matter what someone's, the profession of the person you're stepping in for does for a living, I'm sure it's hard to write something that you know that you're going to have to read to them.
This has been great to talk with you. Congratulations on your children's book. I wish you all good things and look forward to the next time we talk.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Seth Meyers has a new children's book called I'm Not Scared, You're Scared. And of course, you can watch him weeknights hosting NBC's Late Night. The new Pixar animated film Turning Red tells the story of a young Chinese-Canadian teenager who awakens one morning to find that she's transformed into a big red panda. It's now streaming on Disney+. Our film critic Justin Chang says it's one of Pixar's most original recent efforts.
3 years ago, the writer-director Domi Shi won an Oscar for her delightful Pixar animated short, Bao. In telling the sweet and surreal story of a Chinese-Canadian mother and a steamed dumpling that comes to life, it captured something funny and poignant about the cultural and generational differences that can divide Asian immigrant families. With her first feature, Turning Red, she leans further into the complexities of Asian parent-child relationships. And this time, she's come up with an even wilder conceit. If you were to mash together Carrie and the Joy Luck Club and somehow still get away with a PG rating, it might look a bit like this movie. The story is set in the early 2000s, and it follows a 13-year-old girl named Mei Lin Li, voiced by Rosalie Chang, who lives in Toronto's Chinatown. Mei is an obedient overachiever, a straight-A student who spends her free time helping her parents run a temple built to honor their Chinese ancestors. While Mei's father is shy and mostly stays out of the way, her mother, Ming, a terrific Sandra Oh, is attentive to the point of overbearing. In addition to being super involved with Mei's studies, Ming rigorously polices her daughter's social life, in hopes that she won't be too influenced by Western ways. But while Mei may look like the perfect daughter, like any teenager, she has interests of her own. She's starting to notice boys, and she and her friends are particularly obsessed with an NSYNC-style boy band. And then one morning, in a twist that riffs on Kafka's The Metamorphosis and countless werewolf movies, she discovers that she's turned into an enormous red panda with bright red-orange fur and a long, bushy tail. She promptly flips out.
Breakfast is ready. Mm. No sugar.
Coming. Porridge.
Are you sick? Is it a fever? A stomachache? Chills? Constipation?
No!
Wait, is it that? Did the red peony bloom?
No! Maybe?
That last line from Ming isn't the story's only reference to periods. This is surely the first Pixar movie to feature sanitary pads as a plot device. Director Shi, who wrote the script with Julia Cho, confronts the messiness of adolescence with an honesty that's refreshing in the world of studio animation. May's transformation is clearly a metaphor for the onset of puberty, when your body betrays you and becomes unrecognizable overnight. But it's a metaphor for something else, too. As it turns out, the red panda effect is the result of some very ancient Chinese magic that's been passed down to May through the women in her family. It may be a ridiculous setup, but as in most Pixar movies, even the most outlandish plot devices have their own narrative logic. May soon figures out that her panda persona is triggered by intense emotions. Whenever she calms down, she turns back into her human self. Her mom instructs her to suppress her feelings, and the panda along with it. But then something funny happens. Her friends find out about the panda, and rather than being weirded out by it, they think it's the cutest, coolest thing ever. Soon May is newly popular and having the time of her life, and she starts to wonder, what if the panda, far from being some shameful aberration, is actually the truest expression of her happy, goofy, emotional self? And so Turning Red tells a story about shame, repression, and social anxiety, areas that I, like more than a few Asian Americans, know a thing or two about. During the movie, I found myself sometimes wincing in recognition at May's tension and embarrassment as she's torn between her family and friends. I also balked at moments that seemed to exaggerate for comic effect, especially when it came to May's mother, who's clearly been conceived along the lines of the controversial Tiger Mom stereotype. All of which is to say that Turning Red gives you a lot of ideas to grapple with. It also gives you a lot to look at. Director Shi and her collaborators have a lot of fun incorporating East Asian influences into the story and animation. You can see touches of Japanese anime in the character design. May's panda has the fluffy, oversized proportions of Hayao Miyazaki's Totoro. The action-heavy climax manages to salute kaiju movies like Godzilla and martial arts epics like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Turning Red knows that teenage life can sometimes feel like a monster movie, and sometimes it's an action movie. And now, happily, it's a Pixar movie, and one of the bolder ones to come along in a while.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new film, Turning Red. We're going to talk about the hidden world inside our bodies, the remarkable design of our organs, the messages contained in our body fluids, and how things can turn foul when something goes wrong. My guest, Dr. Jonathan Reisman, is an internist, pediatrician, and ER physician, and the author of the new book, The Unseen Body. Each chapter is about a specific body part or body fluid from his perspective as a doctor. So there's chapters on the throat, heart, feces, genitals, liver, brain, skin, urine, blood, and so on. It's fascinating material. But I want to acknowledge at the start that our conversation will include discussion of body fluids. And I know that makes some people uncomfortable or squeamish. I suspect Dr. Reisman will try to convince you that you needn't be squeamish about the complexity of the human body. Before studying medicine, his passion was studying the natural world and ecology. As a medical student, he found that exploring the body felt similar to exploring the outside world. Each organ was a different creature with its own unique appearance and behaviors. He's practiced medicine in remote and culturally unique regions of the world, including the Arctic, Antarctica, high altitudes in Nepal, people living on the street in Calcutta in India, and among the Oglala Sioux in South Dakota. He currently works in several ERs in the Philadelphia area. Dr. Jonathan Reisman, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a fascinating book. I know you're fascinated by our insides, our organs, our body fluids. It's part of what drew you to medicine. But many people are squeamish about looking even at a video of a chest cut open during surgery. Why do you think that the body can seem so revolting or upsetting?
Well, thanks so much for having me here today, Terry. I think that a lot of people are simply, you know, grossed out or repulsed by what they're not used to. You know, when we go about our daily lives, we don't see the body's innards, we don't see our internal organs, and we try not to see the, you know, the excreted bodily fluids that come out of us too. Just our normal daily life does not involve seeing those deeper parts of the body. And part of the reason I named my book The Unseen Body is because I'm trying to open up that unseen portion of the body that we all don't see in our daily lives, pull back the curtain, if you will, on how all the organs work, how fascinating they are, but also how they impact every aspect of our lives from daily life and, you know, all the milestones of our lives from birth to death and beyond.
The first time you cut open a cadaver as a medical student, did you find it revolting or fascinating?
I actually found it absolutely fascinating on that first day. In fact, before the end of the very first day of medical school, during which they had us start in the anatomy lab, which is the class in which we would dissect the cadaver over the coming months, before the end of that very first day of medical school, I decided that when I died, I would want to donate my body for the same medical school dissection. You know, the same thing that was happening between me and the three other medical students that shared this cadaver, you know, kind of exploring its innards and sort of seeing what's inside this strange man that we never knew in life. And, you know, as an extension, when you look inside the body of another person, you're necessarily looking inside your own, seeing how you are built, how organs are, you know, organized inside of you. And so it kind of takes on this very self-reflective and philosophical nature. And I was really taken with that from day one. And resolved, and I'm still sticking to it. When I die, I want to donate my body for a medical student dissection.
Well, let's start talking about a part of the body that does not make people squeamish. I'm thinking of the throat. When you were in med school, you were amazed at how stupidly designed the throat seemed. What seemed stupid about it?
You know, what is its basic function? The throat helps us deal with whatever enters our body, you know, usually through the mouth. We drink, we eat, we inhale. Air comes in through the mouth and the nose. All of it ends up in the throat, and it's the throat's very, very important job to deal with all of it. Specifically, the throat has to take food, drink, saliva, other things that we mean to swallow, and make sure they go into the one tube, the esophagus, the food tube, which goes down to the stomach. The tube right next to the esophagus, literally millimeters away, is the windpipe, which goes down to the lungs. And every single time something passes through the throat, its most important job is to make sure that whatever it is besides air does not go down the windpipe. The design seemed fairly stupid to me because if you mess up just once, if you try to talk while swallowing just once or laugh with your mouth full, as we all know, sadly, you know, you can aspirate, choke, and die just from one little slip up. So it seemed sort of silly to have these two tubes right next to each other. And every time we swallow food and drink, or every time we thoughtlessly swallow our own saliva, which happens basically all day, every day of our lives, that material comes within a few millimeters of slipping into the windpipe, therefore a few millimeters within killing us. And so it seemed like such a really poor design, like maybe food and drink and air could enter the body through different orifices. Of course, it can't because of how we form in the womb. But it seems like a big problem that can cause a lot of trouble, and especially in contrast to other parts of the body, which seemed so exquisitely designed, so brilliantly constructed to keep us alive, to ensure our survival. The throat almost seemed like a really easy way to die.
So to make matters even worse, for people who are older and have weaker swallowing muscles, or who have any kind of like dementia or illness that weakens those muscles, it's so easy to choke on food and have it go down the windpipe instead of down the esophagus. And that leads to aspirational pneumonia. Would you describe what that is?
Sure. You know, any pneumonia is an infection in the lungs. Aspiration pneumonia in particular is a specific kind caused by aspirating food or drink or saliva into the wrong tube, into the windpipe. You know, the throat is so dangerously designed to top off all of its dangers. The number one strain of pneumonia-causing bacteria in the world lives in our throats, right above the entrance to the lungs. And so one small mishap, one little bit of food or saliva can go down there. It can drag those bacteria with it, and that can turn into a pneumonia, which is a very common problem for the elderly and infirm.
Yeah, and I'm sure you've had a lot of patients who've gone in and out of the hospital because they choke easily on food and get aspirational pneumonia, recover, go home, choke again, go back to the hospital, and so on. You say that you came to see pneumonia as an escape hatch for the body at the end of life. Can you talk about that?
I tell the story of Suzanne, who bounced back to the hospital again and again with aspiration pneumonia. And, you know, her end-of-life experience, she ended up dying of that second bout in the hospital. She had made it clear in her living will that she didn't want extraordinary measures. She didn't want to be on a ventilator, and all of her family agreed. And so it sort of gave me this different perspective. It was actually, for me as a young doctor, one of the most tension-free end-of-life experiences of a patient that I had had. These can often be very stressful with a lot of family tensions that are once hidden coming to the fore. But in this case, everyone agreed. It was all very peaceful almost, even though it was sad. But, you know, the aspiration pneumonia came to be seen by me as a way out when your quality of life tends to ebb. You know, when you have dementia and you can no longer think, no longer talk, or no longer recognize your loved ones, your throat isn't working properly and you tend to aspirate. And that aspiration pneumonia that results can almost be a way out from a degraded existence. And while it's never my place to determine when someone's quality of life is too low for them to continue living, this is a recurrent problem that does happen to the old and infirm. And it used to be called old man's friend. So aspiration pneumonia was called this because it often does provide this end, a dignified end to prolonged suffering and illness.
You actually have a favorite body fluid. What is special about urine to you as a doctor?
So urine has a unique place among bodily fluids. You know, most of a doctor's job is interpreting bodily fluids, you know, testing them, sending them to the lab to gather data to figure out what is wrong with a patient, what's the cause of their symptoms or the sign of disease or the pain. But I find that as a doctor, urine really has this broad array of messages it can tell me about my patients. You know, every bodily fluid is a language and it speaks to doctors. And if we can interpret its messages, we can hear what it's telling us about what's wrong with the patient. Urine is kind of the perfect example of this and provides such a wealth of information. You know, for instance, take the color. Red urine can tell me that a patient perhaps has a kidney stone, perhaps they have a urinary tract infection, perhaps they have a tumor on their kidney or on their bladder. In that way, the red color is telling me the possibilities of what could be afflicting this patient. But urine has this ability to tell you about the entire body, not just the urinary tract through which it flows and comes out of the body. You know, so the same red urine, for instance, could be telling me about muscle breakdown, which can turn the urine red. It could be telling me about a problem with red blood cells, all these things that are kind of unrelated to the kidneys and urinary tract themselves. And even, for instance, with diabetes, you know, we end up, it often presents because people urinate a lot. So there's no obvious connection between the pancreas, where the problem is located with diabetes type 1, yet we can find these clues in the urine, and then we often test the urine itself for various chemicals that can tell us about the pancreas and it's failing to make enough insulin. So in that way, this urine is sort of this crystal ball where you can sort of divine all these unrelated things about the body as a whole.
One of the many things you've done in medicine is work as a hospitalist. So what's your diagnosis of hospitals and the ways that they are not suited to regaining health?
The list is very long. You know, sleep loss among the sick is an epidemic in hospitals these days. You know, everyone's losing sleep. No one's sleeping well, partly because of stress and our smartphones and other screens. But, in the hospital too, there's just this constant barrage of noise and alarms going off and light coming in through the windows. And it's very hard to sleep in hospitals. And that's one of their big downsides that would be improved on if people were still at home.
Yeah, you say you used to wake up patients to, like, you know, check their vitals and talk with them. And with terminal patients now, you won't do that anymore.
That's right. When I was training and I had a long list of patients and I was still very inefficient with my my movements, my rounding, where I saw each patient one by one in the morning before I had to meet with an attending physician and kind of describe what I planned to do for that patient that day. And so I often, in a rush in the morning, woke up one patient after the other. I often felt terrible about it. I would hesitate to do it, but sort of the pressure of residency, the pressure pushing me towards having all my plans ready and all my notes written by the time I would talk to my attending sort of, you know, put me, sort of forced me to do it. I don't want to take any blame away from myself. I am one of those healthcare workers who wake people up needlessly while they're trying to get their restful sleep in the hospital. I describe in the book one patient in particular who I had as a resident. He was suffering from terminal gastric cancer, and he was very young, just in his 30s. And every day on rounds, I woke him up in the morning, even though I felt horrible about it, even more horrible than usual, because I knew his case was terminal. There was an oncologist sort of overseeing me and sort of making the larger decisions about treatment and how to manage the cancer. But I was the one sort of examining him each day, writing for his IV fluids, repleting all his electrolytes, which were depleted because of poor diet and the toxic chemo treatments he was getting. And so waking him up in the morning felt especially egregious because I felt like I was sort of waking him up back to the reality of his terminal cancer. You know, instead of letting him sleep more, maybe dream of healthful long life, I was waking him up and almost re-diagnosing him every morning by bringing him back to reality and saying, you know, here you are back in the hospital. It was not a bad dream. And, you know, you don't have many weeks to live. And so from that moment on, I sort of decided for myself, for the terminally ill, unless it was absolutely necessary, I made a rule for myself as a hospitalist, I would never wake someone up again.
You worked with patients who had liver disease, hoping for a liver transplant, and you saw the fluids that build up in the body with that disease and cause a lot of pain for the person who has it. And even when you aspirate the fluid, it tends to build up again. So reading the liver chapter in your book, I thought, this doctor is never going to eat liver again. And it was actually the opposite. You hated liver and you started eating it after attending to patients who had liver disease. Can you explain that?
Terry, my journey to kind of become what we might call a foodie began in medical school, which is the opposite of what anyone would expect. Specifically began in the class anatomy lab where I was dissecting the cadaver. You'd think that would be where people go to lose their appetite completely. But for me, it was the opposite. There was a professor actually who really enjoyed pointing out which of the human muscles we were learning corresponded to which cuts of beef that we might have heard of. So for instance, you know, the infraspinatus muscle of the shoulder corresponds to the flat iron steak, and the psoas major muscle inside our abdomens correspond to the filet mignon. And we learned about which muscles of the thigh correspond to the top round and bottom round and eye of round, etc. And I realized that the same knowledge that goes into understanding the human body, how muscles are shaped, how they connect to bone, help us move, how tendons, ligaments, and joints are all, you know, structured together, how they're designed. That's the same knowledge that a butcher might use to effectively butcher an animal, to get the certain cuts of meat to be in their optimal state for cooking. And so I found that there was a lot of overlap in knowledge that would help me as a doctor and help me learn to butcher. And I actually did in that first semester of anatomy lab. I went to a slaughterhouse to see how they, you know, operate, how they turn these bodies into meat. And the liver in particular was an interesting case because I always thought it was absolutely gross when I was growing up. Chopped liver was often around on holidays, and everyone in my family loved it. I thought it was repulsive, the taste, the appearance, the smell. But after medical school, after I learned kind of a mind-boggling amount about the liver, how it functions on the microscopic level, the cellular level, how it works inside of us and is connected to our other organs, I couldn't quite get over the fact that that incredibly complex biological entity of the liver that keeps us healthy our entire lives is the exact same thing that goes into chopped liver and gets spread on crackers, you know, at my family's holidays. I then couldn't quite get over that, and I thought how sort of magical the transformation was from this living, incredibly complex organ to food. And so it kind of spurred me to try it again, and I slowly got used to it, and now I love liver.
So I know you plan to donate your body to science, which was a decision you made when you were a medical student after cutting open your first cadaver. What is the process like when you do that? I know how to say that you want it donated, but then what happens? And then what happens to the remains of your body after it's donated to science?
It depends on what you want your body to go to. So in my case, I want to donate my body for a medical school dissection, as I experienced from the first day of med school. So actually, in that case, you actually contact medical schools themselves and you donate your body to an individual med school. And then they help with the kind of the arrangements after that. And, you know, once it took about 4 or 5 months for us to dissect our cadavers. And, you know, once we had really looked through the entire body and the persons looked like a shell of their former selves for sure. After that, they're actually cremated, and we had a ceremony at our medical school where we kind of honored these people who we never met and knew nothing about, you know, who donated their bodies so that we can learn. And still to this day, that what I saw inside that man's body is, you know, still what I use to kind of understand what's going on inside of all of my patients and my own body. So it's a very archetypal experience.
Well, Dr. Jonathan Reisman, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's been an honor.
Dr. Jonathan Reisman is the author of the new book, The Unseen Body. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.